Back with you now on The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Nationwide, only 4% of police chiefs are Black. But since 2009, Chief Joel Fitzgerald has been top cop in four different cities. In each, he was the first Black officer to serve as chief. From 2015 to 2019, Fitzgerald served as chief of police in Fort Worth, Texas. He was fired the day he was scheduled to present the FBI with evidence of corruption in the city. Fitzgerald says he was offered a large severance if he agreed not to talk publicly. He refused. And in May 2019, a Texas state appeals panel ruled that Fitzgerald's performance was not the cause of his termination. The panel indicated he should have been honorably discharged. One year after this ruling, in June 2020, Chief Fitzgerald began his new job as chief of police in Waterloo, Iowa. Every year since 2018, Waterloo, Iowa has been ranked among the top five worst places to live for African Americans, according to an annual report by the website Wall Street 24/7. The rankings are based on measures like Black median income, unemployment, and home ownership rates. Fitzgerald started in Waterloo just days after Officer Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd in Minneapolis. It was a police slaying that touched off historic protests around the world, including in Waterloo.
Black Lives Matter!
Black Lives Matter!
Fitzgerald told me about this tough beginning.
Change-making was something that was necessary. My first day interacting with the community here in Waterloo was during the George Floyd protest. I was to be, sworn in on June the 1st, and the evening before, I was out with the mayor and a crowd of about 200 to 300 people just talking and having those difficult conversations with members of the community that were frustrated with the lack of change and the need for reform in law enforcement.
The activism and organizing of the movement for Black Lives accelerated calls for police reform at precisely the moment Fitzgerald assumed leadership of the Waterloo Police. And he told me that careful listening to community concerns and meaningful reform of policing practices have guided his choices in Waterloo.
When I got here, that change had to happen. I had to sit down with some of my staff members and some of the rank and file and work on things like use of force, the duty to report, the duty to intervene, bias-based policing, and other items that have come up, like no chokeholds, things that were brought up even during the Eight Can't Wait movement that we addressed very early on as a part of our promise to the individuals out there that were protesting. And I vowed to them that we would investigate every complaint, that we would promote change within the department, that we would create reforms that were born out of some of the ideas and some of the principles that people shared with me.
One of the first issues Black people in the city brought to Chief Fitzgerald was the police department's emblem. You see, it's an image of a winged griffin adopted in the 1960s. And for decades, Black Waterloo residents have noticed that the mythical half-eagle, half-lion creature also bears a very close resemblance to the KKK dragon. Here's a Black community organizer in Waterloo addressing the chief directly about the logo during a protest back in June of 2020.
How can we respect y'all when you wear that? How can we respect y'all when you ride through our community? They don't serve. They don't protect. It's bad.
It has been something that has been a powder keg for this community, and that has been changed. It was changed as a result of council vote, and as we speak, there's a transition happening where the patch is being removed and being replaced with a new patch that is, something that the community in and of itself can stomach. And if any member or any segment of a community is offended by something that law enforcement's doing, our job is to ensure that we first clarify our position, and second, we try to adapt and make the department something that is representative of everyone in the community.
In a move that is more than a bit unusual for law enforcement, Chief Fitzgerald has granted interviews to numerous media outlets in recent weeks. Here's what he told me about the reasons he is speaking out publicly about his frustrations with his experiences in Waterloo.
you know, the racial microaggressions that I've experienced here, the propaganda that's been put out on certain websites in reference to just changing the patch and questioning your leadership and just certain intangibles. You know, it seems as if, you know, we as black police chiefs are subjected to a different sliding scale sometimes when you have the experience, you have the education, you are you're a change agent, you're a person that brings, you know, about community change, and you get criticized for it.
It's remarkable to hear a police officer point to the injustice of racial profiling, especially considering that unfair scrutiny of black people and communities on the basis of race is precisely the concern motivating efforts to reform or abolish American policing. According to research published in the Stanford Social Innovation Review, of the 2,400 elected prosecutors in the United States, the vast majority are white, male, and approximately 85% of them, they run unopposed for their office. So, when Kim Fox was elected state's attorney in Cook County, Illinois in 2016, she made history as the first black woman to serve as lead prosecutor in the city of Chicago. And race and gender are not the only things that distinguish Fox from her counterparts. She ran on a platform of sweeping criminal justice reform. Now, her work earned her broad support within the black community and re-election in 2020. And it attracted racist, sexist backlash. I spoke with Fox last month during an event for the Vera Institute of Justice. And here's what she recounted.
I had racists march on my office. The Proud Boys, members of QAnon, and the Fraternal Order of Police all gathered together and marched on my office because they didn't like that I dropped charges on a celebrity for what would otherwise in any other place be a misdemeanor. This happened where people literally were taking my photo and rubbing my picture on their genitalia outside of the chief prosecutor's office in the city of Chicago, and the press didn't talk about them.
For more on the challenges facing black law enforcement officials who are creating change from the inside out, we're joined now by Roy Austin, former Department of Justice and Obama White House official. Mr. Austin, great to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you so much, Melissa.
And also with us is Paul Butler, the Albert Brick Professor at Law at Georgetown University, former prosecutor and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. Professor Butler, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Melissa, it's great to be back on The Takeaway.
So I want to begin with you, Professor Butler. Remind us of some of the most common types of reforms that are, in fact, being implemented over maybe the past year or two in law enforcement across the U.S.
Melissa, people of color have been demanding police reform since U.S. police departments evolved or devolved from slave patrols. And police reform has been about combating violence by law enforcement officers, racial profiling, and selective prosecution of people of color for things like drug crimes. And so reform has centered on transparency and accountability. Specifically, now there's been a lot of focus on ending no-knock warrants, which is how Breonna Taylor got killed, getting rid of chokeholds, which are infamous after the news of the last year that inspired the protests about George Floyd. So it's about specific steps that departments can take to make themselves more effective at delivering their services to the community.
So, Mr. Austin, one of the things I want to engage with you here is that in that long push, right, sort of that, if we, again, you know, from slave patrols forward, right, these many, many, many decades of effort, for so long, they had been happening only from the outside in. But now there's also this effort to put into places like, you know, police chiefs or prosecutors, people who themselves are reformers from the inside out. How's that working for those inside out reformers?
You know, it's a tough slog. They are changing the way we look at justice in this country. And for a lot of people, there's only one form of justice, and that is for people of color, lock them up for as long as you possibly can. There's a realization that that hasn't worked, that has not made anybody more safe. It has destroyed communities and families. And so these reformers are coming in, changing the way the old guard gets to do its business, and they are being attacked for doing so.
Paul, given what Roy is telling us here about the that when you are on the inside of the system trying to do this work to change it, that the attacks come, you know, there's not the same kind of respect for the office and the institution, right? The racialization of the people and the racial engendered nature of the people in those roles so frequently leads to these kinds of attacks. Is that part of why some folks say you can't reform these systems, can't reform the police, have to abolish it?
I think that's right, Melissa, and I'm so glad you brought up gender, because in this instance, we have to think about intersectionality. Kim Fox's experience in Chicago is not unique. African-American women elected prosecutors have had it far worse than anybody else, including white male progressive prosecutors. And so I do think the focus has to be on changing the culture. The Obama Commission on 21st Century Policing talked about changing the culture from warrior mindsets, which too many departments have now, to guardians. And if you think about it, the person who applies for a job as a warrior has a whole different set of skills and experiences and objectives than the person who wants to be a guardian. And in order to transform policing, some folks have said, reform is too limited. It's too unambitious, given the scale of the problem.
Roy, even in the role of guardian, though, doesn't it matter who you're guarding? I'm thinking here of lynch mobs who understood themselves as guardians of white women's virtue, and the violence over and against Black men wasn't any different than a warrior mindset.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned respect, and we saw this with Obama. People used to say you have to respect the presidency, and then President Obama came in and you had all these people disrespecting it. Same thing is happening with these Black men and women, especially prosecutors. They're there, and suddenly everybody forgets that you're supposed to respect the institution, respect their discretion. It's just not happening because, again, they are changing the lens with which you look at justice. And a lot of people are very uncomfortable with that because they've only seen justice from the lens of protecting wealthy white communities.
Okay, Roy, can you tell me a little bit more about prosecutorial discretion, what it is and what's been happening with Black women prosecutors who've tried to use it?
Yeah, so prosecutors are largely allowed to decide, because they can't prosecute every single thing that comes in front of them, to decide what they're going to emphasize, what they're not going to emphasize, how they're going to run their office. They're elected to do so. And for as long as I remember, when you had white male prosecutors predominating, they were allowed to exercise their discretion. Well, suddenly you have these Black females and other reform-minded prosecutors in there, and everyone's trying to limit their discretion. And we saw it first, I first saw it with Aramis Ayala, who was trying to limit the use of the death penalty. And she got threatened. Actually, they took away all of her capital homicide cases, because they decided that she could not exercise her discretion as a Black woman prosecutor.
Who's the they in this case?
You know, the they is actually, it's a big they. The they is the media. The they is other prosecutors in Florida for Aramis Ayala. The they is the police. The they is everybody but the voters. Because one thing you will notice is that these reform-minded prosecutors, when they run again, are being overwhelmingly reelected. But the they is the people in power who are not the people who are the voters.
Paul, yesterday we heard from Capitol Hill that the bipartisan effort to work on policing reform has hit what looks like an impasse, that it can't move past. That's at least what Senator Cory Booker is saying. And the issue is qualified immunity. Can you talk a little bit, remind our audience what qualified immunity is, and is there any hope of us ever moving past that impasse?
Qualified immunity is the idea you can't sue me because I'm a cop. It's a doctrine that was invented by the Supreme Court to protect police officers from personal liability. But Melissa, here's the thing. The Democrats were willing to compromise to an extent on qualified immunity, but that still wasn't enough for the Republicans in the Senate, who are staunchly against any kind of police reform. They wouldn't even go as far as President Trump went in his executive order last year after George Floyd was murdered.
So it's interesting to me, Paul, because there certainly was a bipartisan effort around not policing reform, but around incarceration reform. And it was, you know, largely based on a kind of, you know, libertarian ethic within aspects of the Republican Party, and also just a budget hawkishness, right? Just how expensive it is. So why is policing so different than incarceration in terms of the ability to get any kind of bipartisan work going on it?
There are a lot of people to blame for the failure of politicians to respond to this moment. The New York Times says that the protests last year about police reform were the largest social justice movement in the history of the United States. Everybody knows about the infamy of January 6th. Well, last year on June 6th, there were protests about policing in 500 different American cities. There's never been a social justice movement that's had that reach. And one of the organizations that's standing in the way is police unions, Melissa. They oppose almost every effort by activists and citizens for accountability and transparency because they believe it's, I guess, good for their jobs. But the thing is, if police aren't respected and trusted by the people who they're supposed to serve and protect, they're not able to do their jobs as well. So at the end of the day, reform is about public safety.
Roy, we've been talking here a little bit about these intersections of gender, race, and reform-mindedness. And I just feel like maybe it's worth sort of talking about the ways that race and gender don't necessarily mean reform-mindedness, that a Black woman police chief or a, you know, Black male sheriff might or might not be reformers. As you kind of look across the country, where do you see the intersection of all three? Where are the folks who have themselves sort of the intersectional identities and are deeply committed to reform?
So where I see it is in St. Louis with Kim Gardner, Chicago, Kim Fox, Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore. You know, what you just spoke of, though, was what happened in the race in L.A., where in L.A., a Black female non-reformer was beat by a Latino male reformer. And of course, now he's caught up in some of this recall nonsense that is sweeping California. So you see the intersectionality now because you're finally having intersectional prosecutors who are running for office and are winning office. And we are seeing more and more chiefs of color. You know, we should be looking closely at Charlottesville right now. There's some nonsense happening there where a Black female chief was pushed out. Really, it seems like some nonsense being led by the union there, the police fraternal organization. So it doesn't stop. And luckily, there are people out there who are fighting for these chiefs and fighting for reform and fighting for fairness and justice around the country.
So, Paul, on Roy's point, and then also connecting back to yours about the big protests. So if you are not an insider, if you're an outsider, you're trying to get reform, maybe you've gotten a Kim Fox elected to office over in Anita Alvarez, maybe you've gotten a Kim Gardner elected. How do you simultaneously, from the outside, hold accountable these reformers, but also help to protect them from these powerful forces like police unions that want to push them out?
First of all, you have to have everyone understand that when these African-American women take these brave steps, like in Maryland, Marilyn Mosby is not prosecuting sex workers. She's not prosecuting drug addicts because she understands that that's not in the interest of her community. You have to protect them, not just politically, But you have to understand that with issues like bail reform, every now and then there's going to be some case that's in the news that will be used to attack these prosecutors. And folks have to defend them. They have to step up for them. Because, again, it's not just about a kumbaya racial justice equity thing. It's about family and community safety and wholeness. If people are invested in the cops, if people believe and trust their prosecutors, we have better outcomes, and that makes all of us safer.
Paul Butler is the Albert Brick Professor in Law at Georgetown University, former prosecutor and author of Chokehold, Policing Black Men. And Roy Austin is a former Department of Justice and White House official. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Always a pleasure.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.